sharper iron. Spend the next hour with us studying the living and active Word of God. His two-edged sword of law and gospel, recorded for you in Holy Scripture, all about Jesus Christ, crucified, risen, and ascended for you. Thanks for tuning in this morning here on Worldwide KFUO, Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. I'm your host, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. Sharper Iron is underwritten by the Lutheran Church Extension Fund, where your investments help support the work of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Visit lcef.org for more information. On this Thursday, May 2nd, we are studying Daniel chapter 2, verses 1 to 49. In today's text, King Nebuchadnezzar makes an impossible demand of his advisors concerning a dream that he had, but the Lord reveals the mystery to his servant Daniel. To help us sharpen our faith in Christ as we study God's Word today, we have with us returning guest, Pastor Jeffrey Reese. Pastor Reese serves at Zion Evangelical Lutheran Church in Tacoma, Washington. Pastor Reese, welcome back to Sharper Iron.
Great to be back again.
Give us some context as we get started. We looked at Daniel chapter 1 yesterday. What should we know about Daniel as context looking at chapter 2 today?
Well, I think possibly that Daniel, of all the exilic prophets, does the best or focuses the most on the thread running through the narrative of God's salvation, that he is using the exile on one hand to punish his wayward people, but on the other hand to prove his sovereignty and his power over all nations. The very fact that in each scenario going through the whole book of Daniel, you see the Israelite folks who have caught the attention of the kings, being the ones that the kings end up relying on, and then through that actually praising the true God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, shows you that he is advancing his knowledge of his power, still using his people, but making sure that knowledge is known throughout the world and not just to his people. It's almost like he's basically, you guys aren't going to be priests to the nations like I told you to. I'm going to make you priests to the nations. I'm going to put you in the middle of the nations.
Kind of like, I mean, Jonah's an unwilling prophet. The right. People, I mean, I suppose Daniel and his three friends end up being willing in the sense that they testify faithfully, but the fact that they would not have chosen to go to Babylon unless mm-hmm. the Lord had sent them there, it's mm-hmm. a good point, because this is the Lord who has done this. He has brought his people to Babylon, and here they are faithful. So far we've seen in Daniel chapter 1, and that faithfulness, especially of Daniel, continues into the text that we've got for today. So I'm going to read for a little bit here in chapter 2 to set the scene. Nebuchadnezzar and his advisors dominate this first section before Daniel really comes to play later in the chapter. So this is Daniel chapter 2, beginning at the first verse. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. Then the king commanded that the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans be summoned to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king. And the king said to them, "I had a dream, and my spirit is troubled to know the dream." Then the Chaldeans said to the king in Aramaic, "O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation." The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, "The word from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you shall be torn limb from limb, and your houses shall be laid in ruins. But if you show the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and its interpretation." They answered a second time and said, "Let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will show its interpretation." The king answered and said, "I know with certainty that you are trying to gain time, because you see that the word from me is firm. If you do not make the dream known to me, there is but one sentence for you. You have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the times change. Therefore tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me its interpretation." The Chaldeans answered the king and said, "There is not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand, for no great and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. The thing that the king asks is difficult, and no one can show it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. Because of this, the king was angry and very furious, and commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed. So the decree went out, and the wise men were about to be killed, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. Then Daniel replied with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He declared to Arioch, the king's captain, "Why is the decree of the king so urgent?" Then Arioch made the matter known to Daniel, and Daniel went in and requested the king to appoint him a time that he might show the interpretation to the king. And we'll pause there. That takes us through verse 16 of the text.
Mm-hmm.
And so, Pastor Reese, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, it's the second year of his reign. He's got dreams. This is going to be a theme that we see throughout the book of Daniel. There's lots of dreams and visions. What's going on here in the first three verses of the text?
Well, just as it says, the dreams that Nebuchadnezzar has a dream that has troubled him. It's interesting that at the end of the first verse in the English Standard Version, it says his sleep left him. Andrew Steinman, who wrote the Concordia commentary, actually argues that the Hebrew is saying that he went back to sleep. I didn't do a deep dive in the Hebrew, and I'm certainly no Hebrew expert, so I wouldn't know if I could challenge him on that or not. All I can tell you is that every English translation I've looked at says something to the effect of he wasn't able to get back to sleep. And I did do a quick check of the Septuagint, the Greek Old Testament, and the Septuagint seems to agree with all the English translations that he, in fact, wasn't able to get back to sleep. I don't know how important that is, but I thought it was interesting, and I would someday love to ask Dr. Steinman about it. So in any case, he had this troubling dream. There is some argument about whether or not Nebuchadnezzar has forgotten the dream, and that's why he's asking his experts, to his enchanters and magicians and so forth, to tell him what the dream was. But it is also possible, another argument is that he only had a vague memory. You know how when you can wake up and you remember that you had a dream, whether it was a good dream or a troubling dream, you can kind of remember that you had it, and you might have vague memories of it, but you can't remember all of it or any of the details. It may be the case here, and that's another argument. And that makes more sense, because he probably has to remember at least vague portions of the dream in order to be able to know that the enchanters are giving him accurately describing the dream. But I honestly wonder, and I have never read this in a commentary before, but I'm honestly wondering if he's putting his usual experts to the test, because he's already begun to doubt their abilities. And that I do that because of what we read in verse 9. There at the second sentence in verse 9, "You have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the times change." So it's almost as if he's already suspicious that all he has for experts are a bunch of yes men who are always, much like the false prophets I think it was a Second Kings, something like that. They're just going to tell him what he wants to hear. And he's already suspicious of that.
Okay, so the challenge that Nebuchadnezzar lays out to his wise men, and there's a number of different titles that are used, magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, Chaldeans, all the advisors to the king are gathered around, perhaps just yes men. It does seem that Nebuchadnezzar has that thought about them as the text progresses. The challenge that he lays before them, or the request, the command, I suppose, is that he's had a dream, he wants to know the dream. And so the Chaldeans, and I'm not sure if they entirely understand the nature of his request at first. Uh-huh. It seems maybe in verse 4, like, okay, we've done this before. You tell us the dream, we'll tell you what it means. And the king says, no, that's not what I'm asking you to do. You have to tell me what I dreamed and what it means. I'm laughing a little bit as I read it, because it's just such a crazy request that he lays out.
Right, especially from... especially if that's never happened before. And it probably, like you said, it probably never has happened that way before. But like I said, it's almost like he's wising up to the fact that, you know what, they could interpret my dreams any way they want. It would be very easy if I tell them the details of the dream for them to speculate about the meaning in a way that would make me happy, that would make me feel good about my future or the future of my empire. And so again, it goes more to the point that I'm more and more convinced that it's not just that he doesn't remember the dream. He may very well remember every detail of the dream. He is suspicious of their actual abilities, that they're not just a bunch of charlatans. Mm. And then another interesting thing here that that Steinman points out that I really appreciated was when they begin their reply to him, "O King, live forever," which is a very common address to a king in those days. And in the pagan context, this would basically be a prayer, a wish for their patron god to protect the king, to keep the king alive. And it's kind of ironic that later on we're going to hear Daniel show up on the scene and say the same thing. And Dr. Steinman points out that this may very well be kind of an ironic satire or some sort of a sarcastic remark by Daniel, because obviously Nebuchadnezzar as a mortal is not going to live forever. And yet what the entire prophecy of Daniel does is basically express the fact that God's kingdom is truly forever.
Yeah, that's that thought, that God's kingdom is truly forever, is certainly going to come up as we get to the interpretation of the dream, and really is right. A key theme in the entire book of Daniel. We talked a little bit about this yesterday in chapter one, how on the one hand you've got King Nebuchadnezzar, who seems to hold all the cards, but by the end of the chapter, Daniel just very briefly makes mention of King Cyrus. Oh, there's another king that will replace Nebuchadnezzar. Mm-hmm. The eternal reign of God is going to be a huge theme in the book of Daniel, and certainly becomes prominent as this text progresses. So with maybe some of the background that you're positing between Nebuchadnezzar and his advisors, that he's maybe got a sense that these guys are charlatans, they've just been yes men, pulling his leg maybe even, that might be part of the reason why his response or his threat against them, if they can't do what he wants, is quite severe in this case.
Right. And he has, and Nebuchadnezzar has proven that he has no qualms about doing such things. You look at the way he dealt with the king of Israel. You look at the way he's going to deal with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in chapter 3. He doesn't bat an eye before ordering someone's, cruel death. So they have reason to be afraid.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Okay, so he makes a strong threat. In verse 7, then, it seems that these advisors whom the king has called before him, they either think he's not serious, or they, like, maybe we can talk him out of this, and they repeat it a second time, and Nebuchadnezzar, he just doubles down on what he wants from them.
Yeah, and you're just trying to buy time, because you know that, the only way you have out of this is to properly tell me my dream and interpret its meaning. And they can't do it. And honestly, this is in contrast to the thread through Daniel of showing the one God, Daniel's God, to be the only true God. This is exposing them. This is almost a John kind of theme of the light shining in the darkness and the darkness not being able to comprehend it. They're being exposed for the charlatans they are. And what King Nebuchadnezzar doesn't really grasp, though, is the fact that their exposure as charlatans is exposing his whole religion as fraudulent. And we know he doesn't get it, because obviously chapter 3, he builds the golden statue and such.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So it's not just Nebuchadnezzar seeing his advisors for who they are as charlatans, but really their entire system and Nebuchadnezzar's system being exposed for the emptiness that it is. And the words of the Chaldeans in verses 10 and 11, I think, really highlight that, perhaps in a slightly ironic way. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about what they say to the king. I mean, he's said, hey, look, here, this is what you got to do. Talk to us about their response in verses 10 and 11.
Right, yeah. They say there's not a man on earth who can meet the king's demands. And in fact, they're right. And that's the whole point. And of course, what's Daniel going to do when he comes in? He's going to give all the credit to God. He's like, I'm not interpreting your dream. God is. I'm just the mouthpiece. And you know, and then we're going to be referencing King Cyrus here. You see, go through Nebuchadnezzar and Darius and so forth all the way through. And by the time you get to King Cyrus, when he sends the Jews back to rebuild the temple on the order of God, you know, he's just listening to God without question by that point.
Yeah. Okay, so there's not a man on earth who can do what the king demands. No magician, no enchanter, no Chaldean. The king, he's asked something too difficult that only, and in the words of the Chaldeans, no one can do this except the gods, and their dwelling is not with flesh. I know we're, about 600 years here prior to the incarnation, but it is striking the conception of the pagan gods that these Chaldeans have compared to what the true God will do in a few books from where we are right now in the beginning of the New Testament. So any more on the words of the Chaldeans there before we're going to get Daniel here coming up here, but anything more on verses 1 to 11?
No, I think we're at a good place. We set the stage here for Daniel to show up. Just that they can't do it. They're not lying at this point, but again, their exposure as frauds, they have no recourse, but we can't do it, you know?
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So verses 12 and 13, then this is where Daniel now shows up in this chapter again. And so the king's, he realizes these men are not even going to try. They know they can't do it and they're not going to bother. So he gives the command for his threat to be executed. They're about to be destroyed. I guess in verses 1 to 11, Daniel and his companions are not present for that initial meeting, but now they are going to be included with those who are going to be executed along with those men who couldn't fulfill what the king wanted.
Right. Basically, they're all lumped together, and it's probable that not all of the Babylonian wise men were there at the time. It was probably a representative number of them. And in any case, Daniel and his three companions are lumped in with all the wise men. Yeah. And it's interesting that, you know, Daniel's basically going to save all their necks, presumably. Yes. I mean, it doesn't really tell us whether the systematic killing of all the wise men had started or not. But whoever is still alive, if any were killed, Daniel's saving their necks.
So. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think that there's something to that, as we will see, that Daniel steps in and ends up saving not only himself and his three companions, or the Lord does that, but the other wise men of Babylon are spared as well because of what the Lord accomplishes through Daniel. I think there's something to that. Maybe since we're here, we can talk just a little bit about it. I mentioned it yesterday that the presence of God's people in Babylon ends up blessing the Babylonians, even if they don't always have the eyes to see it at the time. And I think you see it in chapter 2.
Right, indeed. And then again, all the way through, and all the way through to the Epiphany after Christ's birth, when where do the Magi come from? They come from the East. How did they know? Well, because they had Daniel's writings.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the Magi. This section of Daniel, especially the first 11 verses, when you read it in the Septuagint, the word magoi is used to translate one of the groups of advisors that are mentioned. Those are the same ones that show up in Matthew chapter 2. And so to see who the Magi were in Daniel 2, and then seeing them show up to worship Christ, the newborn king there, is a shocking thing, but also helps to see, well, how did they know to look for it? The people of God were there in exile, and there this word was spoken and was apparently held on to and believed by people 600 years later.
And then, of course, the Babylonians or the folks here are going to either forget, or the word about Daniel is not going to be passed on to the next generation of Magi, because what happens under King Darius, but they throw Daniel under the bus.
Right. That's right. That's right. Yeah, it's remarkable how often in the book of Daniel, the Lord will show himself to be the true God through Daniel and his friends. Mm-hmm. And the people, it seemed, get it for a moment, perhaps, but then by the next chapter, they've forgotten yet again. So,
and we can all relate, which is why we go to the divine service every Sunday, because we need what it gives over and over again.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So the king is rounding up all of his wise men, those who were present, those who were not, and they're all about to be killed. And when Daniel comes and he's being rounded up along with his companions, he speaks to Arioch, who's the captain of the king's guard, and says, "Hey, what's going on?" And Arioch lets him know. And Daniel goes in and requests an appointment with the king in order to show the interpretation to the king. Now, one thing that stood out to me and I didn't really notice this until I was reading it in preparation for our conversation today, is that Daniel makes this appointment to tell the king what he wants to know even before he knows what he needs to know, which I think is quite the leap of faith on Daniel's part.
And it's in complete contrast to the Magi who had been advising the king up to now, that Daniel knows without knowing, because Daniel belongs to the one true God, and he knows that God will. And there may be in his mind almost something similar to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego when they're about to be thrown into the fiery furnace, and they say one last time, "We will not bow down to this idol, and we know that God will save us. And even if he doesn't, we're still not going to bow down to your idol."
Yeah, that's right. An attitude like that does seem to be in the background of what Daniel does there in verses 15 and 16, saying, "Give me the appointment so I can show him the interpretation," even though he doesn't have it at that moment. Then, as we will read here in a moment, he goes and prays and includes his three friends in this prayer, "Please pray with me so that the Lord will deliver them." But it is, the contrast that you brought out between the pagan advisors on the one hand and Daniel here. In the moment of crisis, the pagan advisors realize the absolute worthlessness of their religion and they despair. In the moment of crisis, Daniel realizes the true genuineness of his religion, and he doesn't despair, but he leans upon the one who has promised, the Lord himself.
He's not afraid of anything that man can do to him, because he knows that that he is of the Lord.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so we come then to the verse 17. We keep reading in the text. Again, Daniel has requested the appointment with the king in order to show the interpretation, but he doesn't have it yet. So the text continues now in verse 17 of the chapter. "Then Daniel went to his house and made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, and told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, 'Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's matter.' Therefore Daniel went into Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus to him, 'Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will show the king the interpretation.' Then Arioch brought in Daniel before the king in haste and said thus to him, 'I have found among the exiles from Judah a man who will make known to the king the interpretation.' The king declared to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, 'Are you able to make known to me the dream that I have seen and its interpretation?' Daniel answered the king and said, 'No wise men, enchanters, magicians, or astrologers can show to the king the mystery that the king has asked. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head as you lay in bed are these. To you, O king, as you lay in bed came thoughts of what would be after this, and he who reveals mysteries made known to you what is to be. But as for me, this mystery has been revealed to me, not because of any wisdom that I have more than all the living, but in order that the interpretation may be made known to the king, and that you may know the thoughts of your mind." That takes us through verse 30 of the text. We'll pause there in the middle of Daniel's speech. So I've got about a minute and a half here before the break, Pastor Reese. Help us again. So Daniel, he's asked for the appointment for the king, but he doesn't yet know the interpretation. Talk to us about his next move in speaking to his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah.
Yeah, his next move, of course, is to do the main part of our vocation as God's people, and that is to pray. Pray and seek the mercy of God. And understanding that this is a mystery. At this point, Daniel, as we're going to see unfolding in the verses you just read, Daniel doesn't really know what he's up against, but he trusts God, he trusts Lord Yahweh that much. And so he enlists his friends to pray while joining him in prayer.
Yeah, I love the way that you said that the main part of the vocation that we have as Christians is to pray. And I think we often forget that within our vocations, you know, when we think about what does it mean to be a faithful parent or a faithful child or a faithful employee or employer, and we go through, say, the table of duties, and those things are all helpful, no doubt. Mm-hmm. But to start with those vocations in prayer, I think is such a helpful perspective that we see from Daniel and that we would do well to pick up today as well.
Well, yeah, and how often do we hear people say, and maybe we ourselves say, all I can do at this point is pray, and you almost want to respond, and I have responded a couple times, is, what do you mean all you can do? That's the most important thing that you're given to do.
Yeah, that's right. And so Daniel and his friends pick that up right here at this moment of crisis, putting their trust in the Lord, and we will see how the Lord does not disappoint but vindicates their trust in him as we look more at this text on the other side of the break. You're listening to Sharper Iron on KFUO. We're talking to Pastor Jeffrey Reese this morning. We will be right back. Please stick around.
Did you know that an investment with Lutheran Church Extension Fund exclusively supports LCMS ministries and church workers? That's right. LCEF ensures LCMS churches, schools, and organizations have access to the financial resources they need to sustain, strengthen, and start ministry work. In other words, you can feel good investing with LCEF because we share your Lutheran values and love for the church. Learn more at lcef.org. LCEF is a nonprofit religious organization. Therefore, LCEF investments are not FDIC-insured bank deposit accounts. This is not an offer to sell investments or solicitation to buy. LCEF will offer and sell its securities only in states where authorized. The offer is made solely by LCEF's offering circular. Investors should carefully read the offering circular, which more fully describes associated risks.
Welcome back to Sharper Iron. It is Thursday, May 2nd. We're studying Daniel chapter 2, verses 1 to 49 with Pastor Jeffrey Reese. He serves at Zion Evangelical Lutheran Church in Tacoma, Washington. Pastor Reese, prior to the break, we were talking about Daniel, who along with his three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, call out to the God of heaven in prayer, asking him to make known the interpretation to Daniel for the sake of his appointment before King Nebuchadnezzar. In verse 19, we find out that the Lord answers the prayer, reveals the mystery to Daniel, though we do not yet find out the mystery yet. That will come in the text. Before Daniel goes to his appointment with the king, he first blesses the God of heaven in what I think I would call a doxology of sorts in verses 20 to 23. Help us into Daniel's praise of the Lord there.
Yeah, doxology is a great word for what's going on here. And notice that even before he has said anything of substance to the king concerning the dream, he is expressing, basically giving God all the glory for this, that he's basically setting it up for it to be understood that this is not something that I have done through some sort of divination, but the Lord has laid the answer to this mystery. The Lord has laid it on me, and that's the only reason that I can tell you what I'm about to tell you. And the way the language he uses, and in 21, especially because it's related to the vision that we're about to unpack, the God who removes kings and sets up kings. It's a direct expression to Nebuchadnezzar that not only will he not live forever, but he may well not even, you know, be a king much longer.
Yeah. What else?
The pleasure of God Almighty and not his all desire.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so the Lord, the God of Daniel, is the one who changes times and seasons, who allows kings to serve at his good pleasure. He's the one who gives wisdom to the wise. What else do we find out about? What else does Daniel say about the Lord here?
Revealing deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. And there's that darkness and light motif again that I referred to earlier that we see in Gospel of John and other parts of the Old Testament as well. And then he concludes it by giving thanks to God, giving thanks to the one true God, the God of my fathers, and expressing the fact that he has given Daniel the wisdom to be able to make known to the king what's troubling him.
All right, so having prayed to the Lord, received the answer to his prayer, blessing God, thanking God, confessing who God is prior to going to the king, then it is time for Daniel to go to the king for the appointment that he has made already. That happens in verse 24. He goes back to Arioch, and Arioch goes to, well, here, before we get there, actually, this is what we were talking a little bit earlier, Daniel's words to Arioch, do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. There, uh-huh. I think we do see the blessing that Daniel and the Israelites are within the land of Babylon, and maybe uh-huh. even just a bit of the intercessory, the priestly role of God's people there, as uh-huh. he says, spare these men of Babylon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so that seems to indicate that the killing had not started yet, right? And again, that it is the people of Israel who are doing a priestly work, intervening, intercessing on behalf of others. Even among you know, the goyim, the Gentiles.
That's right. We talked a little bit about it yesterday, that and where how these things match up chronologically, I suppose we can't know for certain, but depending on when, like, Jeremiah's letter to the exiles gets there, when Jeremiah is telling the exiles, hey, seek the welfare of the city, even if that comes after this event, you see that very thing playing out, that Daniel and his friends are in fact seeking the welfare of the city. They are interceding on their behalf. Daniel steps into the breach, not only for himself and his three Israelite friends, but for all the wise men of Babylon, says, give me my audience with the king. I'm going to show the interpretation. Arioch brings Daniel in haste and say, hey, hold on a second, king. Here's a guy who can help you out. Take us into that just initial back and forth before we get to Daniel's speech to the king.
Sure. And Arioch may very well have friends among the Magi. So Arioch himself may be happy to hear that he doesn't have to kill his fellow Babylonians. And obviously Arioch's not going to go back on the king's order, because then Arioch will just be, you know, thrown in with them. He's obviously relieved at this. And so he you know, and the fact that he brings him before the king in haste shows the fact that he's seeing hope here, that this order from the king might not have to be carried out if Daniel can in fact do what he promises to do. I was going to make a note here. You may have talked about it yesterday. In verse 26, Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, and you see the Hebrew names of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego earlier. They were all given these names by the Babylonians, and each of the names has within it the name of a Babylonian god. So they were, you know, it's interesting that these guys who are named after false gods by the Babylonians are now hearing the word of the true God from those very people.
Yeah. And it is the name that includes the false god is the one that false god lets the Babylonians down. And it is the ones who bear the name of the true God, both, you know, I mean, in a very literal way, Daniel, right? There's the name of the true God there. They are the only ones that can do what is being requested, because there is only one God. you certainly see the impotence, the foolishness of idolatry in this mm-hmm. section of Daniel, and the reminder of the, oh yeah, remember how you renamed him? You really need him as Daniel here, because it is only the true God who can help you out. So the two men have been introduced, Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar, and now the king has asked, Daniel, can you do what I need? Take us into how Daniel begins his response in verses 27 to 30.
Yeah, and he starts out by saying, agreeing with what the what his experts, his so-called experts, had said to begin with. And no, where they said, no man on earth can do what you request. And Daniel says, no wise men, enchanters, magicians, or astrologers can show the king the mystery that the king has asked. And then, but there is a God in heaven, the very God whose name I just praised and gave thanks to, who reveals mystery, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. And so he opens with the summary of what the meaning of the dream is. And then he goes on and starts to describe, or will be starting to describe in the future verses, what exactly the king saw in his dream. So he's already getting the king's curiosity up as he explains that this is, in fact, revealing what's to come.
Talk about what Daniel says about himself and his role in all of this in verse 30.
Right, yeah. And again, he makes himself just the mouthpiece. You know, this mystery has been revealed to me. It's not because I'm smart. It's not because of any wisdom that I have. But it is for the interpretation, you know, to be made known to you. So that you can understand what's been going through your mind, and it's all coming from God.
Yeah.
And it's honestly a good lesson for all of us pastors too. You know, and I try to, you know, when I get complimented on my sermon or whatever, I try to respond with, I was blessed with really good teachers, you know, or obviously, you know, it's, you know, good sermons come from good material, and we have the scriptures, you know.
That's right. But yeah, that's right. Yeah, God be praised for using us as his mouthpiece. It has nothing to do with our wisdom, but is entirely his wisdom that he speaks to us in the scriptures, and we are privileged to make that known, not simply, well, to kings, to be sure, but to all people. And so here, the Lord has placed Daniel as his mouthpiece to Nebuchadnezzar, so that Nebuchadnezzar may know the thoughts of his mind. And that then brings us to the interpretation. Well, it brings us to both what the dream is and to its interpretation. Again, that was the request that was made long ago. We don't actually know at this point what the dream is. Daniel's going to tell Nebuchadnezzar both the dream and its interpretation. So we pick up the text again with verse 31. You saw, O king, and behold, a great image. This image, mighty and of exceeding brightness, stood before you, and its appearance was frightening. The head of this image was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its middle and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, and its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. As you looked, a stone was cut out by no human hand, and it struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold, all together, were broken in pieces and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away, so that not a trace of them could be found. But the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This was the dream. Now we will tell the king its interpretation. You, O king, the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, and the might, and the glory, and into whose hand he has given wherever they dwell, the children of man, the beasts of the field, and the birds of the heavens, making you rule over them all, you are the head of gold. Another kingdom inferior to you shall arise after you, and yet a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And there shall be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, because iron breaks to pieces and shatters all things. And like iron that crushes, it shall break and crush all these. And as you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it shall be a divided kingdom. But some of the firmness of iron shall be in it, just as you saw iron mixed with the soft clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly iron and partly clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly brittle. as you saw the iron mix with the soft clay, so they will mix with one another in marriage, but they will not hold together, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, nor shall the kingdom be left to another people. It shall break in pieces all these kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it shall stand forever. Just as you saw that a stone was cut from a mountain by no human hand, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold. A great God has made known to the king what shall be after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation sure. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face and paid homage to Daniel, and commanded that an offering and incense be offered up to him. The king answered and said to Daniel, "Truly your God is God of gods and Lord of kings, and a revealer of mysteries, for you have been able to reveal this mystery." Then the king gave Daniel high honors and many great gifts, and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. Daniel made a request of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel remained at the king's court. That takes us through the end of chapter 2 to verse 49. All right, so Pastor Reese, talk to us first about the dream itself in verses 31 to 35.
Yeah, you've got the frightening statue that the king saw. And 31, you saw, O king, and behold, a great image. Whenever you see that kind of doubling down on seeing something, you saw and behold, that's sort of a, let's take notice of this, something big has happened. This is a mighty image. It's of exceeding brightness, and its appearance was frightening. And then you see the different materials each portion of the statue was made from. So you start out with gold, then there's silver, and then bronze, and then iron, and then the iron and clay. And so the statue gets sort of more and more inferior in its materials as you go down. And then, of course, with iron, as it's going to be referenced later, iron is the strongest. It breaks other things to pieces. But it's also inferior in that it's not something you're going to use to decorate something like you would for gold or silver.
Right.
Or bronze. Okay,
right. So there's the statue itself, starting with gold at the top. By the time you get down to the toes, you've got the iron, and it's even mixed with clay. That's the frightening statue. And then Here comes this big stone. Talk to us about the stone that comes.
Yeah, and this is probably my favorite part, because to whom does it point except Jesus? You know, right. This is the stone. This is the rock of our salvation. This is the stone that the builders rejected. You know, this is the foundation of our faith right here, shattering the world's religion, so to speak, shattering all of paganism, basically.
Okay, so the stone in the dream itself, and you're already giving us the interpretation here, but within the dream, that stone smashes this image completely,
right. Mm-hmm.
And then it becomes, the stone actually becomes a mountain that fills the whole earth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course you see all the descriptions when we're talking about the fullness of the presence of our presence with God, which is to come, you know, that's often described as being on a mountain.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so a number of things that we're going to be able to pick up from the dream itself. Daniel isn't as specific as we are going to be in the way that he speaks to Nebuchadnezzar, but he certainly points us toward the way that these things reach their fruition into the New Testament. So the interpretation that Daniel gives comes starting in verse 36, and he first begins with the statue, and he has some very flowery words to describe Nebuchadnezzar's role within the statue when it comes to this head of gold. Talk to us about the way he speaks about Nebuchadnezzar.
Well, yeah, he starts out by saying the God of heaven has given you this kingdom, has given you this power, has given you this might and this glory. And so he's speaking nicely about Nebuchadnezzar, but he's also pointing out that Nebuchadnezzar has all of this at the pleasure of the one true God. You know, in 38, you know, into whose hand he has given wherever they dwell, the children of man, the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens. Basically, he's saying you're ruling. Essentially, he's basically saying you're essentially ruling over all of creation,
right?
At the moment. So there's almost an Adam-like expression here in terms of having dominion, the humanity's role, vocation of having dominion over the earth, and putting Nebuchadnezzar in that at the top of that.
Right. But even in all that, he is not the God who has given this.
Right.
There is a God who is over right. Nebuchadnezzar, even as the one, even with Nebuchadnezzar ruling over the known world, still the Lord remains over all things. And that's a key point here.
Right. And he's very clear about Nebuchadnezzar's power. All of this dominion that he has comes from God and God alone, kind of pointing forward to Romans 13, among other places, of course. And even then, when he starts to go into the next kingdom to come after him, he expresses that the kingdom that's coming after him will be inferior.
All right, so take us into the coming kingdoms then, to the silver, the bronze, the iron and clay.
Yeah, well, and I want to point out to folks who tune in tomorrow with Daniel chapter 3, I'm assuming, that the golden statue that is built is probably a replica of the top of the statue that he sees in his dream here. Because again, Nebuchadnezzar is going to forget very quickly, or at least misunderstand. And so he's thinking maybe that he's doing something good, when in fact he's basically creating another version of the golden calf. Yeah. But anyway, hope I'm not stealing somebody's thunder tomorrow. But anyway, so then you have, the next kingdom. The gold is Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom, more than likely. The silver would be the next kingdom inferior to you. And it's interesting that it's inferior to you, but it's still going to arise. Because again, it's God at work here. God is the one who sets up kings and tears down kings and sets up kingdoms and so forth. And then the kingdom of bronze after that, the kingdom of silver might well be, probably would be the Medes and the Persians. Then after them, of course, you have, what is it? My mind's gone blank. The Greeks. And so forth. You have, and then of course the iron would almost certainly be the Romans. And then as the Roman Empire starts to crumble, you've got the iron and clay kind of thing going on there.
I think especially the identification with the Romans toward the end is where you really have to go with this, because it is during that time that it is in the days of those kings. That's where we get to verse 44, where the Lord establishes this kingdom that will never be moved. I think, you know, when we think about these visions and dreams that Daniel has, because this isn't going to be the only one, we sometimes do need to be careful about being too specific as to like identifying always a particular king exactly. Mm-hmm. But the picture is pretty clear that there's going to be this succession of kingdoms that is going to be decreasing in nature in some way, yet you have this iron kingdom. But during that time, that's when the Lord's going to establish his kingdom that has no end. And that's really, I think, where you're driving to the point. So take us especially in the verses 44 to 45 and what the Lord says about this kingdom that's going to be established in those days.
Yeah, and this is when God is going to set up his kingdom. And this is another reference in 45. You have that stone coming back into play here. And then you think about the use of the word kingdom in the Gospels. You know, what does Jesus say? He says, "My kingdom is not of this world." And yet that's precisely what Jesus came to do, was establish God's kingdom among God's people. And the throne that Jesus ascends to initially, at least, is the cross.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. The kingdom of God is such a huge theme in the book of Daniel, and certainly within this chapter, and the way that he establishes it here through Jesus, who, I love the reference you made to Psalm 118. That was one that was going through my mind. The stone that the builders has rejected has become the cornerstone. So it's mm-hmm. not a stone that's been hewn by human hands that we as the builders would have rejected it. This is the Lord's own choosing. And having recently studied Isaiah here on Sharper Iron, the passage where the Lord says, you know, I alone, I am the rock. There is no other God. That this is who he is. And then the fact that it becomes this mountain that fills the whole earth, again, having recently read Isaiah, and the way the prophet Isaiah thinks about in a number of places and proclaims that the Lord will bring the nations to Mount Zion. He will mm-hmm. draw all people to himself through this kingdom now that has been established in those days. This is what the Lord is up to. And this is what Nebuchadnezzar has seen. And this is the interpretation of the dream. And Daniel says, the dream is certain. The interpretation is sure. Here you go, king. This is what it's all about.
Yeah, and you see similar expression in the prophet Ezekiel, especially in, I forget if it's chapter 36 or 37, I get my Ezekiel chapters mixed up sometime, but where God basically starts talking about the restoration of Israel, and he says, it's not for your sake that I'm doing this, but it's for my name's sake, because I will be exalted among the nations. So all of this in Daniel, you're seeing the same thing. It's being made very clear that God is the one who's doing all of this, and his people are just vessels through which he's doing it. They're basically an unwilling priesthood.
Sure, even as Daniel does give proper confession, they're in Babylon to Nebuchadnezzar. So the dream has been certain, its interpretation sure. Daniel's speech ends there. Nebuchadnezzar reacts in verses 36 and following. Talked about his reaction toward Daniel and his words to Daniel there in the verses that come.
Yeah, I mean, Nebuchadnezzar is obviously taken aback. Like I said, he was very suspicious of his original wise guys, I might call them. and yet here, it's obviously, well, especially since he was going to have all of them murdered, including Daniel and his friends, it clearly never occurred to him that there was someone who could interpret his dream. And here someone has, and now he's been... He's had the light of the light of God shone upon the reality of who God is for him, who the real true God is, and what else can he do but fall on his face, but worship, and then express a confession of faith in Yahweh, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Daniel's God, the God of Daniel's fathers, as he put it earlier. Truly, your God is God of gods and Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries. For you have been able to reveal this mystery. So notice he says, you've been able to reveal this mystery, but he even also follows Daniel's lead and gives the credit to God.
Sure, yeah. And of course, a little bit of misunderstanding on Nebuchadnezzar's part, because in verse 46, it does seem that the worship, at least in part, is offered toward Daniel. There's an offering and an incense offered up to him.
Oh,
it seems
sure.
That there's, you know,
that's true.
Certainly... Some misunderstanding, but yes, with it, even from his own mouth comes a confession of some truth at least, right? I mean, he gets it partly right. Again, we're going to see in the next chapter, he forgets whatever he's gotten right.
I think
he forgets.
What's happening here is so. For instance, the most rulers had a patron god, and Nebuchadnezzar's, if I remember right, was Nebu, and there would have been probably the first thing in Nebuchadnezzar's mind is, well, this is obviously Daniel's patron god, and there's a connection between the two of them, a divine connection that he's understanding, and even to the point where that golden statue, which is probably a replica of the top of the statue from his dream, he's probably doing that because he wants to make that his pagan, or not his pagan, his patron god. You know, yeah. he probably thinks he's making the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is patron God. But again, much like the people of Israel tried to identify the golden calf with the God who delivered them out of Egypt.
I think that's a real good connection to hold on to as we prepare to look at chapter 3 tomorrow. Take us into the very end of this chapter then, where the king now exalts Daniel and grants Daniel's request concerning his three friends and their Babylonian names, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego.
Yeah, basically given that it was Daniel's God who accomplished the king's request, on account of that God, Daniel and his friends are being given glory, an earthly glory to be sure, but glory.
Yeah, so. That's right. So there you have the account of chapter 2. We see Daniel's faithfulness in the face of persecution. We also see the faithfulness of the Lord and the way that he does remain truly king over all, even over Nebuchadnezzar, and will establish his eternal kingdom. About a minute here, Pastor Reese. We talked about a whole lot. Just to kind of wrap things up, final thoughts on Daniel chapter 2.
Well, Daniel chapter 2 is a really good summary of what's going on throughout the entire book of Daniel. It's one of my favorite chapters, so I was really excited to get to talk about this one. And really a really great summary, as I said earlier, of what's going on through all the prophets, these situations where God is using his unwilling people, much like he did Jonah, to be priests to the nations where they had failed to do so. He's still working through them. And there's something about that that can be comforting for us, because how often do we find ourselves doubting whether we are living up to God's will for us? And to understand that God is accomplishing his will through us oftentimes, and perhaps best when we're not even aware of it. Because what happens when we are aware of it, we tend to get prideful or boastful of ourselves rather than of God. He uses his servants the way he uses his servants, and we don't have any control over it. And that's a good thing. That's a very freeing, lifts that burden of worry off of us about how well we're doing with God. If we are faithfully receiving his gifts, if we're loving God, loving our neighbor, according to the abilities we've been given, then we are indeed going according to God's will.
Pastor Jeffrey Reese serves at Zion Evangelical Lutheran Church in Tacoma, Washington. He has been helping us today to study Daniel chapter 2, verses 1 to 49. Pastor Reese, thanks for being our guest today.
It was fun. Look forward to the next time.
I am your host here on Sharper Iron, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. If you have any questions about Daniel 2, send an email to kfuo@kfuo.org. It is always a joy to hear from you. Tomorrow we will pick up Daniel chapter 3 and see this image that Nebuchadnezzar makes. What is he thinking exactly? Perhaps it is in connection with the statue he's seen today, but he is wrong in his idolatry. And the three young men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, will place their faith in the Lord and his deliverance, and the Lord will vindicate their trust in him. We will pick up that text tomorrow. Thanks for spending the morning with us today. Talk to you again tomorrow.
Showing support for KFUO is now easier than ever. You can sport a KFUO shirt, swag, or even socks by visiting our online store. Go to kfuo.org/store and order high-quality KFUO-branded merch. You no longer need to wait for our annual share-a-thon for a chance to show your KFUO spirit. Visually share and wear this ministry out in the world by checking out our selection. Every purchase helps to support our proclamation of Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. Go to kfuo.org/store.